Today, the Supreme Court issued its ruling striking down Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, allowing for federal benefits for legally married gay couples and potentially allowing for gay marriage in all of California with regard to Proposition 8. Though the ruling is not a surprise, we are saddened for our nation, even as we call our fellow Christians to faithfulness and prayer. And that is part of a statement released by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And to help us understand better the Supreme Court ruling, as well as the implications for the church, we are pleased to have with us at this time Maggie Carner, who serves as a dual role with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, overseeing two vital mercy ministries focused on protecting the sanctity of life and providing emergency and ongoing health services where needed most around the world. Hello, Maggie.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're only too happy because I was kind of going through the internet trying to figure out what is all this about, and I got confused because there were conflicting or contradictory reports. Could you begin by indicating to us what you believe the Supreme Court actually adopted today?
Sure. And just remember, as we, you know, as you read the newspapers and surf the web and hear the news on the TV, that depending on who's reporting or who's analyzing the situation, you're going to have different talking points, just like you will from me, because it depends on what side of the fence, per se, they might be on. So it's important to listen to all sides to try to get a really comprehensive understanding of what happened today. And that's still going on because, you know, the rulings were just released this morning, and all the legals have been pouring over these documents all day. And the analysis is still happening. And I have to say, you know, the SCOTUS, or Supreme Court of the United States, when they announced the DOMA decision, that was pretty clear. But the Proposition 8 decision is, quite frankly, a mess. And
could you just give a little background for our listeners about what precipitated this, the DOMA, what does that mean, and also Proposition 8?
Sure. DOMA stands for Defense of Marriage Act, and that has been the rule of the land. Bill Clinton signed that into law years ago, and that was challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court because there was a gay couple that said that they were not extended federal benefits for their legal marriage in the state that they lived in, because the Federal Defense of Marriage Act did not extend federal benefits to gay couples who were legally married in this state. And so they challenged that in the court. The important thing to remember from the DOMA decision, and I think that, you know, that the important thing is to remember is that they got their definition of federalism wrong. They said that the federal agency shouldn't dictate to the state, nor vice versa. But it's important to remember that there was no sweeping Roe v. Wade type decision here. They did not, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater. In essence, the Supreme Court reaffirmed the state's right to determine these types of social decisions for themselves, and said states can determine what their own state definition of marriage is. But then they went a little too far and said that state law can then influence federal law. And from a pro-life decision, this is really complex. It's interesting to note that that language that came down today in that decision on DOMA, that language may ask the pro-life argument future when any challenges against Roe v. Wade. So, because that says states have a right to determine their own laws. So it's really interesting how we can, you know, there's lots of different nuances to decision.
A Time magazine recently had every state and what each state was doing, because they were given that right by the Supreme Court not that long ago. And, for example, some states won't allow an abortion unless the woman sees the child within the womb, and you know how they do those things. And others are saying, well, after so many weeks, you can't have an abortion. Is that what you're speaking of, where the states now have the right to make rules like that?
Right. States have varying laws on abortion restrictions. And so this type of language that came down from the DOMA decision today may serve to reinforce that fact if it's ever challenged, and it will be challenged in court. So from the pro-life perspective, the language that came down today was pretty helpful. But from a federalism point of view, it was a little distorted.
Yes.
It's also worth noting that Justice Kennedy recognized that while states can define marriage for themselves, they do not have to recognize the marriage laws of other states. So it's not like they completely, ruled all of this unconstitutional. They didn't wipe out DOMA. They just said that one portion of DOMA was unconstitutional. They struck down section.
What would that mean about, say, someone who got legally married in California and then moved to a state where such marriage wasn't recognized? What implications does that make?
Well, they would still qualify for the federal benefits, but they wouldn't qualify for any state benefits that they might have received in their new state.
Thank you.
Okay. When it comes to Proposition 8, and remember, these are two completely separate decisions that came down today. We believe that decision was wrong. Number one, because, and you need me to talk about what Proposition 8 entailed, or have you already briefed your viewer or your
No, we really haven't, and just a quick summary would be most helpful.
Okay, Proposition 8 was a good thing. The voters of California, under a ballot initiative, said that they did not want same-sex marriage in their state. And that was Proposition 8 on their ballot, and they passed that. And so what happened, though, is that a couple of gay couples challenged that in the court. And when they did that, the court sided with the district court there, sided with the gay couples, and said that they were not going to uphold Proposition 8. And it went up through the courts, and what happened was that while the government officials have all said that they would not enforce Proposition 8 for these couples. And as it went up the court, because the government officials were not going to defend this law in court, there were some proponents of Proposition 8 independently that said we would like to advocate for this law as it goes up through the court system. And the California court said that that's fine. The California Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit Court there in California said that they're allowed to file, these independent supporters of Proposition 8 were allowed to file the appeal. So it went up the court all the way to the Supreme Court, and they argued it before the Supreme Court. All it did, the only thing that essentially what the Supreme Court did today was say that these people who argued the case did not have legal standing to argue the case. So, and bear with me here because it's kind of confusing. So essentially, the Supreme Court today did not rule on the constitutionality of Proposition 8. The only thing they did was remand it and vacate the decision back to the California District Court because they said that the proponents that argued the case for Proposition 8 did not have legal standing in any federal courts to file the appeal.
Did they indicate who could have legal standing?
No, it was just vacated and sent back. So right now, as it stands, Proposition 8 remains in effect there, but we don't know who it remains in effect for. Does Proposition 8 remain in effect for everybody, but those affected officials who were in that suit and that have been banned from enforcing it by the Supreme Court and those two couples? Or does that mean that Proposition 8 will not be enforced in the entire state?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. So it's very confusing. It's the district court in California said that Proposition 8 ruled that it was unconstitutional. The elected officials didn't appeal, but they allowed independent supporters to appeal. California Supreme Court and the Ninth Court said that they were allowed to do that, but the Supreme Court today said they weren't. So essentially what's wrong, the sad thing, is that the citizens of California who passed this ballot initiative, fairly and legally, were not able to defend the law that they passed. Now, the interesting thing is in the California Constitution, it is said in their constitution, it said that state initiatives and statutes that are passed legislatively must be followed unless they're overturned by a federal court of appeals. Well, that hasn't been done. Only the district court overturned it. They've got one district judge that overturned it. So it's a mess. It is a legal hornet's nest at this point. And no matter what you hear, you know, there's people celebrating, and I was on Twitter today, and, you know, there's all kinds of people, you know, on the gay marriage side of things that are, you know, having parties and all this sort of thing. But I really feel like this situation in California is a mess, and it doesn't clarify anything. It just makes it more confusing.
This Supreme Court ruling is almost as confusing and hard to understand as theology.
Yeah, exactly. Although we have the benefit of the Bible and our confessions to really clarify certain elements and the basics. We all have the basics. But, you know, what the scope of the Supreme Court decision today on Proposition 8 means for... You know, what does that mean? It's going to be up to a lot of debate and a lot of litigation. So there's going to be a lot of lawyers very busy.
As an individual, therefore, who is involved in this, how do you see the church then responding to this? What's your advice?
Well, that's pretty clear. You know, as Christians, we will always believe and confess that God himself is the gift of marriage is a lifelong union between one man and one woman. And we believe that same-sex unions are contrary to God's will. Gay marriage is not, in the eyes of God, marriage. And as Christians, we're called to proclaim that truth no matter what you see in the news or, you know, how the culture is leaning one way or the other. Because marriage is that fundamental piece of society. It really, you know, and it's important to remember that government originally, all through history, has recognized marriage because it's an institution that benefits society in a way that no other common relationship does. And it does that because it's the ideal institution of having and raising children. And remember, children are at the heart of this discussion, too. So as a church, our job is to proclaim the truth, to care about families, to uphold the sanctity of marriage, and at the same time, you know, plainly proclaim that those that are seeking forgiveness, repent, and show genuine sorrow over their sin are forgiven and loved. And as Christ Church, you know, we are all seeking forgiveness and love, and we're going to follow Christ's lead. We're going to have humility toward this. People are going to give them care, no matter what they look like or what their opinion is. We're going to care for them and proclaim the gospel of grace and love and forgiveness through Christ. That's our job. That's pretty clear. That's not confusing at all. And that will continue as this thing unwinds through the court system. And, you know, the news every night, you're going to hear a different interpretation. So no matter what you hear on the news, our job as a church, it's very clear.
You're, I understand, married to a pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a very personal question. If you were in a state that permitted gay marriage, what implications would that be for ordained pastors? What would be his options?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because I do live in a state that permits gay marriage. My husband is a pastor and we live in Connecticut. So it is legal here. It's a very blue state in many ways. One of the things that we're concerned about over time is our ability to protect our religious freedom. Will, over time, so far we haven't been challenged in this area, but if my husband does, you know, signs marriage certificates for the government after a wedding in our sanctuary, does that mean that he has to marry anybody, you know, that wants to get married? And at this point, we haven't been challenged, and my husband, you know, marries people that are seeking to be married, and one man and one woman that is seeking to be married in the Christian church and under the eyes of God. So we haven't had that challenge to our religious freedom yet, but we're concerned about, you know, as this whole issue steamrolls, what will be the implications for the church and our ability to maintain our religious freedom to disassociate ourselves from performing these types of same-sex unions?
There's no doubt that in my 28 years of ministry at a church I was at, there were a number of weddings that I refused to do. Some of them were even members. For example, one occasion was the gentleman was going to marry a woman he had gotten pregnant, but he didn't love her. He just thought he had to do that. And therefore, the guidelines for proper marriage weren't there. So I refused to do the wedding, and they both ended up agreeing with me. And there were four other situations. And never has the government, I think, challenged pastors to marry whom they wish according to the religious tenets of their congregation. Well, wouldn't gay marriage just be another religious tenet that we would refuse to participate in a marriage?
Well, absolutely, but how long we can maintain that independence, you know, because as an ordained pastor that is given the legal right to sign marriage certificates and perform civil ceremonies and marriages in the state of Connecticut, how long will my husband be able to say, no, I'm going to marry this couple, but not this couple? Now, traditionally, for years, the church has always been given the sovereign authority to determine who they will and won't marry. But now that, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act is threatened and Section 3 has been struck down, what does that mean in practical terms for clergy? And how, whether a church can remain sovereign over its religious faith.
I was in Novosibirsk for some time. It was very interesting there that the marriages conducted by the pastors were not considered legal by the government until a government individual came in and participated in it and then gave the vows that needed to be made there. That's something
right.
That doesn't happen in the United States, but it's something that could happen, you're saying?
Well, and it's very common to do it that way in Europe and many places in Europe as well. So, that is a clear separation of government, the role of government, and the role of the church. But here, traditionally in the United States, since our founding of this country, the church has been able to act as a steward of the government for that role of, officially notarizing weddings or marriages. I don't know, in the future, if we feel threatened that our sovereignty to be able to determine which couples we marry and which we don't, if that is threatened, I don't know what our recourses will be at that point.
Well, we do have that Bible verse, we obey God rather than man.
Absolutely. And this is something that I think the materials online at lcms.org/free-to-be-faithful are very helpful in this realm of understanding the intersection of church and state and how the church navigates its way to a sometimes very complex culture that we live in right now.
Could you repeat that once more, please?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's lcms.org/free-to-be-faithful. There's a lot of good information up there on the website, and President Harrison has posted a lot of things up there, and it's critical that we as a church body understand how we can maintain our religious freedom in the light of some of these questionable, disappointing cultural changes that we're having to face these days.
I also understand that your editor of Notes for Life, is that mm-hmm. found at that website, or is that a different website?
Honestly, I don't know, but if somebody wants to go directly to it, it's lcms.org/lifelibrary. And it's up there. You can go to all the past issues, and there's a lot of good stuff on our LCMS website people are unaware of, I think. It's a treasure trove of good information for research and just helping you navigate the world you're in.
In a few weeks, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod will be assembled in convention. If there was a late overture in regard to this Supreme Court ruling, what would you suggest it might contain that the delegates could vote on?
Oh, my. these overtures are put together by committees of very learned men and women, and they usually debate these things for a long time. So for me to postulate about an overture by myself, I think that's above my pay grade. But I think that over the next few years before the next convention, we're going to have to really consider seriously what the culture is, the changes of the culture, the direction of the culture that we live in, and address some of our future overtures in convention the next time around. You'll see that there's one in particular at convention this year that affirms the work that we've been doing in educating our folks in the pews about our need to be engaged in the public square on these issues of religious freedom.
Yes, we're taking a look at what the convention could do. One of the more balanced news reports I heard talked about what the Supreme Court justices did, but they weren't that clear. But then they followed up with that the Southern Baptist Convention has already made a statement on that. Is it something that can also be done by, what would you say, other denominations besides the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod? Would the Roman Catholics be standing with us on this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, we've been working closely with them. There's a solid coalition of conservative confessional religious groups that walk together on these issues. And we walk in stride on these things.
If somebody wanted to get a hold of you, do you have an email address, Maggie?
I sure do. It's maggie.karner@lcms.org.
Okay, and once more, please.
Maggie. You want me to do it again?
Yes, please.
maggie.karner@lcms.org.
LCMS.org. And what kind of input would you like to hear from our listening audience and others?
Oh, just any comments or ways that their local congregations are engaged in this work in their community and in their states. I think it's interesting to hear what's going on in the grassroots. I think that would be encouraging.
And also, if the particular state they're in, because KFUO is worldwide, here's what the state is now adopting, et cetera. That would be something that you probably get a hold of, but it would be good from listeners also.
Sure, yeah. And I'd like to hear what's going on in individual conversations as well.
I'll tell you what's very helpful here. You've helped me a lot, because normally when you hear a Supreme Court ruling, it seems so negative at times. But then when you find someone like yourself who's looked into it more, it's more balanced and it has some items in it that doesn't mean what a lot of people are saying. And I think the way you began the program was, we need to be careful when we're listening to the mainstream media or other media and really also be looking at folks with other points of view.
Absolutely. And it's important to understand, what is the opinion of that person who's speaking to you? Because everybody comes to their opinions with a little baggage, whether you're a reporter and you claim to be unbiased or not. So it's important to know that. And also, I listen to a variety of different media outlets just so I know what people are saying. And when I do my research, I look at both sides of the fence.
I think one of the most important things you shared with me, the way I'm going to start off, I'm going to say, that Supreme Court ruling, Kennedy ruled that if somebody was married in a gay state, that will not be recognized by other states. Did you know that? And they're going to say no, because that information isn't really front and center at all, is it?
Right. And that's one of the things that we, those of us who are very concerned about maintaining the sanctity of marriage between one man and one woman, we have a big job ahead of us, and making sure that we communicate the pieces of this decision that are encouraging, because this fight is going to keep going on. We have a lot of work ahead of us. And whenever you're dealing with a court that goes on and on and on, endlessly, because this thing, especially Prop 8, is going to be challenged and litigated, so the rest of us are blue in the face. I assume that the Defense of Marriage Act, there's a lot of things that were struck down today that Congress will have to take up and figure out what to do about.
You know?
So there's a lot of legislation that you'll see coming across the news here in times to come as well.
Well, I really want to thank you, Maggie Carner, for being my guest today on Law and Gospel. Maggie Carner, Director of Life and Health Ministries of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, serves a dual role with the Synod, overseeing two vital mercy ministries focused on protecting the sanctity of life and providing emergency and ongoing health services where needed most around the world. And Maggie, anytime you like to be on the air, I know KFU will be only too happy to hear from you as ongoing developments take place.
Well, thanks for having me today.
God bless. Thank you so very much for being. Tomorrow on Law and Gospel, we're going to continue this conversation looking at it from a theological point of view on Ruminations Thursday with our good friend Wes Reimness. Till then, I'm Tom Baker. God bless.
Listen to Law and Gospel on KFUO Radio. You can write Pastor Tom at KFUO Radio, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. Or email lawgospel@lawgospel.com. Law and Gospel is archived for your listening convenience at KFUO.org.